be seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom for our first oral argument in the new year, the new decade. And on behalf of the court, we wish you a good new year to all of you. We have with us two groups of students. We have Lakeshore Technical School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And Germantown High School, would those students please stand? Woohoo! And what to my wondering eyes show? Can't have any more outbursts from the bench.
Be Anne started it.
Oh, sure.
It's all my fault.
We want to express a welcome to the students. Some are here specifically with a particular program that the court runs, namely Court with Class. This is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin in this court. We invite students to come to court. We send them, if they accept the invitation, materials about the case that they'll hear. They may engage in a variety of activities related to that case. They come, and a justice is assigned that day to meet with the students after this second case. The subject of the discussion is the procedures of the court in taking cases and in deciding cases. The substantive issues of the case are not before the court. And not before the court at lunch in a discussion with the students. And everybody is invited to that discussion. It is not limited to the students. Before I introduce the court, is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. It's much easier to, maybe all of the Lakeland students, Lakeshore, I'm sorry, technical school students would like summaries. It's easier to understand the case if you have a knowledge of the facts and the particular issue that is involved. So let me proceed by introducing the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. You will meet with Justice Ziegler after this case and will be joined by other students who are here for the first argument. Next in line is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and her left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll now call our second case for today, 08AP1703, Dawn M. Sands versus Menard, Inc. Representing Menard, Inc. is Beth E. Hannon, Attorney Hannon. You may proceed, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, I am Beth Hannon, here on behalf of Menard, Inc. With me at Council table is my law partner, Sean Stevens.
Ms. Hannon, I suggest you might want to raise the podium so that the microphone is closer to you. We keep changing podiums so that the lawyer doesn't know where to find the raise button. There you go.
Can you hear me?
I think that's better.
Good.
But we'll see. Keep your voice up.
I will do that. We're here today about a very important right, a client's right to choose its lawyer. That is not a novel or an obscure right. It's a right that has long been protected by state policy and state law set out in our Constitution, in our case law, and in our professional conduct rules. Continuing to preserve that right in this case will comport with the standards of review of an arbitration award and will not diminish any of the policy forbidding unequal pay or the right to be free of retaliatory discharge. And at the outset, I would like to say what this case is not about. It's not about whether the respondent, Ms. Sands, could even bring a claim for retaliatory discharge. It's not about whether other wrongfully discharged employees and other circumstances may be able to seek reinstatement as a potential remedy. It's not about how other ongoing proceedings between these parties at the circuit court level, which are currently stayed, should be resolved. Nor will your decision in this case result in any circumstance where Ms. Sands has to refund the over $1.6 million that she was awarded and which Menard has already paid. Now, despite the thick appendices, which include a lot of testimony and reference to facts, we're really only here on a single legal question. That is, can Menard Inc. be forced to reemploy a lawyer whom it has discharged, with whom it is in conflict, and when the attorney-client relationship is broken?
Ms. Hannon,
yes.
The reinstatement here was the product of a decision made by an arbitration panel.
Yes, it was.
Who selected that panel?
My understanding is that Ms. Sands' counsel proposed an array of employment lawyers,
the parties
between themselves decided on the three employment lawyers for the panel.
One question that occurred to me as I was preparing for this case is that if it was a matter of such import that reinstatement not occur here, I wonder why the parties didn't take more of a hand in fashioning the parameters of the arbitration process itself, such as to avoid the outcome that occurred. It seems to me that if the parties are hiring the arbitration panel or selecting them, I guess we could use hire, I assume they were paid. I wonder why that wasn't done at that process, or at that stage of the proceedings.
To some extent, it was done, Justice Gableman. If you had a chance to look at the arbitration agreement, which is begins at page 97 of our appendix, it allows at paragraph 4 the claimant, Ms. Sands, to relay to the panel the nature of the claims that she'll be bringing to the panel and the nature of the relief that she sought. So that limited what the panel could do because it's part of the party's agreement that empowers the panel and what she told the panel.
But that doesn't necessarily, yes. What you've just read to me, I have had the opportunity to read it, and it's still, to my mind, that seems to me not to provide a parameter. It provides guidance as to what they're going to consider. Did the parties have the option of telling the arbitration panel, we're going to hire you to arbitrate this matter, but reinstatement is not one of the outcomes that either of us wants? I know her testimony. I know she's the statement about no reasonable person would order reinstatement under these circumstances. If there was or if there wasn't, I'm just trying to figure out why it couldn't have been done. If it couldn't have, please let me know. But if it could have, I wonder why it wasn't in such black and white terms.
Certainly. The statement, I want one of the alternative remedies, I want front pay and I don't want reinstatement, could have been said more clearly. But there's no dispute between the parties that Ms. Sands only asked for monetary remedies, and the case law as well as the employment statutes identify that you can't get both. It's one or the other, and she elected front pay, and that's what she asked for in her post-hearing briefs. The bulk of the testimony offered at the hearing itself was going to the substance of the claims, and the nature of remedies sought wasn't really the focus.
It seems, and this is the last time I'll ask it, I don't want to take away valuable time. It seems to me the parties here, and I might be wrong, and if I am, please let me know. My impression is that the parties contracted here for an arbitration process, and the parties together collectively, they set out what they wanted the panel to do in terms of the process. And certainly claimants ask for things all the time that are not awarded, or the deciding panel awards something other than what the claimant seeks. So I don't think, it's not readily apparent to me that the request itself would have provided that limitation. If the parties viewed the front pay or not front pay, as opposed to front pay versus reinstatement, as a material part of the process, the question just occurs, why wasn't that set out for the hired members of the panel in black and white?
Well, as far as a why, I don't know that you're going to get more of an answer from what's in the record. What's in the record is what they did. And first, the parties had some negotiation back and forth about what their arbitration agreement should say.
So maybe it was more of an assumption that, look, if the former employee is not asking for it, the former employer is certainly not asking for it. Neither party is certainly, it's very clear from the testimony that the former employee is not asking for it.
Certainly.
The assumption then was that the panel would not have awarded.
And I think it went beyond a mere assumption. In part, if you look at a chart that Ms. Sands had in her first post-hearing memorandum, so before the panel issued its decision, it's a chart that lays out the range of monetary damages that she wants. There's no reference whatsoever to reinstatement, and you can't have duplicate remedies, reinstatement, front pay, mutually exclusive. So there's that premise. I think if you look at the facts that describe the extensive discord between the parties and the immense emotional reaction of Ms. Sands, those two certainly go to her statements to the panel before their award. Reinstatement is impossible. No reasonable person would want that in these circumstances.
Ms. Hannon,
yes.
Let's assume for a minute that we find in favor of your client. That means that there won't be reinstatement. Does this matter then go back to the arbitration panel for the award of front pay?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Why not?
It does not for several reasons, starting with the panel itself and the agreement. The parties agreed that the panel's jurisdiction would end as of December 31st, 07, and the panel itself confirmed that when there was a subsequent motion by Ms. Sands asking labeled clarification but wanted another $1 million or so. Panel declined to do that, said we have no more jurisdiction. If the court refers to our statutes, the legislature has said, it's 788.10 sub 2, that when the panel's jurisdiction has expired, the matter does not go back to them for reconsideration. Beyond that, practically, and this may even be at least between the lines in the arbitration award, is that the panel rejected her request for front pay. That's what she asked for, not reinstatement, but they rejected it. And on the same page in discussing the extent of back pay, it's essentially the same reason, failure to mitigate.
Isn't she entitled under the circumstances presented here to one or the other, to either front pay or reinstatement? And if you're saying, too bad, so sad, you don't get reinstatement, then isn't she entitled to be awarded front pay?
Not in these circumstances. And it doesn't mean that she is bereft of any remedy for her retaliatory discharge claim, because she did get substantial back pay for that part of the claim, as well as for her equal pay claim, and the compensatory damages for her emotional distress of $100,000 is also an award for the retaliatory discharge claim, as is the $900,000 in punitive damages. So she is not uncompensated for either of the claims on which the panel found for her.
So it's your client's position that she's not entitled to any front pay because the panel rejected that, and she's not entitled to reinstatement because of the right to choose counsel under these circumstances.
That is the umbrella reason, right, Your Honor, for reinstatement.
Yes. So she's not entitled to reinstatement, and she's not entitled to front pay.
Exactly. And there's no statutory provision for such a mechanism to go back at this point. The limited case law on it, we cited Diversified versus Slotin, that allows going back to a panel for a minor recalculation. It's not clear from that case if the panel had said our jurisdiction is over or not, which is the case here. But that's all the guidance that we have says the parties made their agreement for how they would obtain remedies, duration of panel jurisdiction, and she is to be content with the substantial compensation that she received.
Counselor, isn't the award of either front pay or reinstatement, aren't they both equitable remedies?
Yes. Well, and also deemed compensatory, yes.
Okay, well, if in their equitable nature, what is it that causes this court to be without equitable authority to remand it, if not to the panel, to the circuit court?
I would have a concern about what this does to review of arbitration awards in general. That if the court wanted to send something back for consideration of an award the original panel had rejected, there's no dispute the panel's jurisdiction is ended. That we may lose the efficiency that arbitration procedures are designed to have. I think it would create more problems than it would solve. And as I think I started to say in answer perhaps to Justice Crooks's question, the failure to mitigate principle would still apply, which was a serious consideration for this panel when it allowed back pay only up to the point that the substantial job offer Ms. Sands received from a Chicago firm was turned down by her at a salary more than the panel even ordered Menard to pay her.
Ms. Hannon, the practical effect here of your argument is that the arbitration's panel view of how much Ms. Sands should get is defeated. The panel thought under the law she was entitled to reinstatement, and that had a value, right? She asked for 2 years of front pay, but they gave her, and they even set forth what her salary should be, right? So she's not getting what the panel wanted her to get. And you say that the panel rejected her offer of or her request for front pay, but the panel rejected your client's request that she get nothing. So we have to figure out how to deal with this arbitration, and as you say, our review of arbitration is very limited. Parties get what they bargain for, namely the arbitrator's decision, not the court's. And so we're under 78810. Now Judge Lenz looked at what would happen, what could happen if reinstatement was not ordered, and what the various alternatives were. He thought maybe the parties ought to go back to arbitration. They don't have to go back to the same panel, but you still have an arbitration agreement. Two, he thought that the court should provide a substitute value. The panel decided she ought to get reinstatement. The court, trial court should, and the jury should decide what the value of that is if the if Menards is not willing to do it. And third, there could be a separate lawsuit, which in effect would give an opportunity for reinstatement. So those were the alternatives, because the concept was that the, if you're going to do what the panel said and you're going to take away reinstatement, you're going to have to give a value. Now, that's just a summary of Lentz. You were stating several moments ago what the issue was in this case. And I want to know whether your issue is that you can never have reinstatement if there is a retaliatory firing of a lawyer, and there was ill will between the lawyer. By definition, there's ill will, right? I mean, they fired her, they're not happy, right?
There's discord on both sides.
She didn't like them either, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's not unusual in this kind of lawsuit, is it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So, my question to you is this a total no reinstatement when you've got a lawyer, corporate client, in-house counsel, or is your position no reinstatement in the, under the particular facts of this case? Now, I read the brief of the amicus, and the way I read it, it was never in-house counsel reinstatement.
That's
against
how
the wishes, right?
That's how I read that brief.
Okay.
But
how,
that's
what is the issue in, that you're presenting?
It's fact specific.
Pardon me?
It's fact specific. This case, these circumstances. And that's why I said at the outset as to what this case is not about. One of the things it's not about is asking for a bright line rule that there could never be a claim for retaliatory discharge by a lawyer. I'm not asking for a special lawyer rule. But if we look at case law that talks about employees with fiduciary responsibility and sensitive confidential positions and policymaking roles, whether it's a CFO, a CEO, some other highly placed lawyer or official, some of these same real difficulties in asking that person to come back and advise the company.
Well, suppose she wasn't general counsel, she was one lawyer in a, how large is this division? Councils? 7, 8? I've forgotten.
I'm not certain myself, but there are a number in several different divisions.
Suppose she was one of them instead of the head person. Would that make a difference?
I think the key is client choice.
But that is true of any lawyer. That's why I'm pressing you.
Well, what I think part of this distinction could be, Chief, that there might be a lawyer who perhaps has more ministerial roles that the client actually would not be opposed to having that person come back. That could happen. But in these particular circumstances, it's always been Menard's position that it's discharged the lawyer. It is now paid for the wrongfulness of the discharge, but that this relationship cannot be resumed. And it certainly was Ms. Sand's position until really about till the point of appeal that this would never work. She did not want to go back.
She said that to the panel.
Right.
And the panel considered that. The panel said, well, you know, this is she's not happy, they're not happy, but that when you look at the policy of retaliatory firing, and if you look at the policy of the equal pay, that you just can't say that the employer can get rid of the person. Therefore, we take that as more important as a policy than the other. Now, the other thing I want to point out is this is a very special client-attorney relationship. For example, you don't have to be licensed in Wisconsin to be a corporate counsel, right?
Correct.
And not necessarily the same rules apply. in terms of professional conduct, because you've got a double-barreled relationship, employer-employee and attorney-client.
Many of the rules do apply, and Ms. Sands has conceded that. You started out saying the special relationship. Her position and the position that she's now asking to regain is...
Her present position what?
Her position, the one that she's now asking to regain, is one that deals with the upper management of the company. And it's the nature of that role and the hostility. I question that the panel truly considered hostility in making the reinstatement award after it spent so much time itemizing facts of discord between these parties and awarded $1 million essentially for this familial angst, this emotional discord, humiliation, etc. The panel itself essentially said this is unworkable, but went ahead and awarded it.
If I may, I would like to understand a little bit the workings of 788.10 and 788.11. 788.10 is vacation of award, and I see, and I think it's your appendix 72, the award. Point one in that award is reinstatement, and then there are all the other things. So if you're under 788.10, does that vacate the entire award or just part of the award?
Part of the award. For a short time at the circuit court, Menard asked to vacate the entire award based on some other considerations, but those have not been maintained on appeal. So it's only to vacate reinstatement.
But now, under 788.11, talks about modification of award, and that seems to me to allow someone higher up to a court to focus on paragraph one and modify that. I think that's right in the statute, isn't it?
Your Honor, modification. My understanding of the case law on that is it's more in line with the diversified versus Slotin case that I cited earlier. It's a minor recalculation, a mathematical error correction, not reworking or reinserting something that the original panel already rejected.
There's no latitude then under 788.11 for a reviewing court to modify part of something where it's not just a basic miscalculation. We either have to go, and this goes to Justice Crook's earlier question, we either have to say that Ms. Sands has to go back as general counsel Menards when everybody hates each other, and there are all kinds of legal principles involved, or she gets nothing in terms of front pay. Make that choice. There's no middle ground that we can find here.
I just don't want the court to overlook the fact that Ms. Sands received over $1 million on the retaliatory discharge claim, that she has maintained her high marketability as a lawyer, that a reason to modify award shouldn't start from the premise it was legally flawed. The panel manifestly disregarded something, and now we should try to squeeze in a modification. That, I think, would harm this court's arbitration jurisprudence going forward. My light is on.
You don't think 788.11 applies, then?
I do not, Your Honor, and I
all three of those subdivisions relate to minor events.
They do. That's how I read the case law.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. We'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Daniel R. Schulman, you're going to be introduced by John Ritchie. Mr. Ritchie?
Yep. Good morning. My name is John Ritchie, a lawyer with the Eau Claire Law Firm of Ritchie, Wickstrom & Wachs, and I would like to introduce to you today Attorney Dan Schulman from the Minneapolis firm of Gray, Plant & Moody, who will be presenting the oral argument on behalf of Dawn Sands.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
Mr. Schulman, you're a member of the Bar of Minnesota?
Yes, I am.
In good standing?
Yes.
And you wish to be admitted pro hoc vici for purposes of today's argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are so admitted.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Thank you for permitting me to argue in this court. We're here because the arbitrators did something that nobody asked them to do. And there are three questions, I think, that are raised by that, which I'd like to address. Number one, why did they do it? Number two, were they entitled to do it? And three, if they weren't entitled to do it, what happens next? And I know there have been a lot of questions about three. I was going to start with that anyway. Now, the case of Gallagher v. Schnurker says, when an arbitration award is vacated, it is almost certainly required that some provision be made as to what is to follow the vacating of the award. In this case, we have Ms. Sands, who is wronged, is absolutely innocent here. She didn't ask for reinstatement. That's what they did. On the other hand, we have Menard, which is a wrongdoer in this situation. We also have a situation where I think it is clear that the arbitrators intended that Ms. Sands be compensated going forward. Even though they awarded reinstatement, they clearly enunciated in the award that she was to start at a salary of $166,000, that it was to go to $175,000 on January 1 of 2008. She was to be restored to her position as vice president and executive general counsel with all the benefits and accoutrements of that position. And that she was to get an instant profit-sharing bonus of 15%, even though technically she didn't qualify for it. So it's clear that they intended for her to receive compensation going forward, that was part of the reinstatement. So to vacate the reinstatement and not to allow her that is obviously to frustrate the award. Now,
Counselor, are you here really asking that we keep her reinstated, or are you before us because you want us to send it back to figure out how much more money she's owed?
Well, as a practical matter, that's the way it's going to turn out, or it should turn out, no matter how it's resolved. If you affirm it, right now, Menard has gone on record, it's never going to reinstate her. And they've been held in contempt. And Judge Lenz has scheduled a hearing, it's been stayed because of these proceedings, to determine the value of the reinstatement to provide her with the damages that she's the remedial damages under the contempt statute. So if you affirm, that's what's going to happen as a practical matter.
Okay, so we're just talking about money here, correct?
Well, we're talking about how much money, that's what's going to happen below, but you're also talking about her right to reinstatement and whether the arbitrators were wrong when they awarded that right. I mean, that is important as a matter of principle.
Counsel? Well, it's also important for your recovery. If we say that she was not entitled to reinstatement, period, you still have the question of what do you do with an award whose intent has not been fulfilled?
Right.
if you say she's entitled to reinstatement as a matter of law, you have a much easier case on a contempt, and you have a much easier case of, if they don't reinstate her, of you getting damages.
Well, they're not going to reinstate her, so if...
And aside from your client, how the court rules on this case is important for other people, other corporate counsel around the country. I mean, it's not unusual, at least from the cases, that the corporate counsel are fired, they're terminated, and you get a case under termination at will of an employee at will, or you get it under a retaliatory statute. It's just that this is a first arbitration case, but there are cases that are not arbitration cases involving corporate counsel.
Yes, there are, and the federal cases, all of the cases under Title VII and the Equal Pay Act, the few cases, the ones we found that have addressed this, say that they do have a right to sue. Now, counsel says that they concede that, but it's important in those cases that when they say there's a right to sue, they don't put any limits on it. They say you have a right to sue under the Equal Pay Act, under Title VII, and they don't limit that right. Those cases don't say, yes, but you're going to have damages and not reinstatement. And reinstatement, it is conceded, is the preferred remedy under Title VII. Yes.
I'm trying to think this through a little bit as a practical matter. Assuming she worked as counsel for Menards or any corporate counsel or general counsel, there are times when... You know, when I worked at a law firm, if someone came in, you ran a conflicts check, and you could either accept them or not as a client. You could take the case or not and work through it. There have to be times when general counsel have to work through potential conflicts as well, right?
Of course.
Maybe negotiating a deal or working on a case or something. How does that work when counsel are conflicted out? Is it their call? Do they get a waiver from their client? How do they deal with that? And then what do they need to do?
Okay, in the first instance, the all of the argument here about conflicts of interest, assuming she's reinstated, there's no conflict of interest because she's in litigation with Menard, that's over. So the question is, if one of the conflicts they raise is the idea of the hostility, now, that she may have toward them. Now, that is not something for them to raise. That's something for her to consider and resolve under the canons of ethics. She has that responsibility to decide, am I able, am I mentally able to handle this matter?
How long do you think it'd take before they filed an OLR complaint against her?
Sorry?
How long do you think it'd take before they filed an OLR complaint against her once she acted on a matter that they think she has a conflict on?
I don't know the answer to that, but...
Very long, it seems.
Well, it depends why they do it, and, I mean, if she does something she shouldn't do, of course they have a right to file an ethics complaint against her. But if she is conscientiously exercising her responsibilities as general counsel, she should be allowed to. Now, for 7 years, she did that. For 7 years, she was the general counsel is the conscience of a corporation, and she did that faithfully for 7 years. When that ended was when she told them that they were breaking the law with respect to her, and she was right.
But we're trying to figure out going forward what we do as a practical matter. Can this person really assume the position of general counsel and fulfill that responsibility? And can the client be, or you know, her boss, be comfortable with her filling that position? Is it even a workable possible outcome?
Yes, it is. And first of all, there are two parts to it. Can she fulfill the responsibility? As a lawyer, that is for her to determine. That's her professional consideration. The second is their right to a lawyer. Now, it was pointed out earlier, they may, of course, for 7 years, they were perfectly satisfied with her. But when they made her a lawyer, they had a choice of whether or not she'd be outside counsel, an independent contractor, or should she be an employee. When they made her an employee, they obtained certain very significant benefits by doing that. One is cost. They were paying her $29 an hour instead of, you know, hundreds of dollars on an hourly rate. The second was access. There she was. They had her all the time. The third was control. They were the ones who would tell her what to do. And the fourth was exclusivity. She was not representing anybody else. Those are very significant benefits that you get from having an employee. But at the same time, there's a trade-off. When you select an employee, when you make somebody an employee, that is a tacit agreement that you will be subject to all the laws that regulate employer-employee relationships, including federal laws, not just the ones that you like or not just the ones that are convenient. So their right to pick their lawyer is not unlimited. And because of the choice they made to make her an employee, there are paramount considerations here, including the federal anti-discrimination laws, which say reinstatement is a preferred remedy. I mean, if you affirm, as I said before, if you affirm and they continue, which they've said they would, they're not going to reinstate her, then what we do is we go back for the contempt hearing, determine the value of the reinstatement.
Counselor, I want to talk to you a little bit about case law, and case law that discusses what is the remedy when an arbitration panel exceeds its authority. Because that's one of the arguments that's made by opposing counsel, is that this panel could not order reinstatement because it violates both Supreme Court rules and the constitutional right to choose one's own lawyer. Under KADEC, the court concluded, KADLEC, it's a Court of Appeals case, 2004, Wisconsin Court of Appeals case. There, an arbitration panel ordered that a fee be paid to an unlicensed realtor. And both Iowa and Wisconsin require that a realtor be licensed before a fee can be paid for the sale of property. And so the Court of Appeals concluded the arbitration panel acted outside the scope of its authority, and it exceeded its lawful authority. If I parallel the requirement to have a license for a realtor with the requirement under the Wisconsin Constitution that one is free to choose one's own counsel, why then does it not follow that I shouldn't conclude that this panel exceeded its authority when it ordered reinstatement, and under KADEC, that was the end of the story? They never sent it back to figure out what to do next. That was just the end. Why shouldn't I do that?
Here's the answer. You are, because here you are dealing with an issue of federal law. If, first of all, what you're talking about is, if that's the way you come out on this, then what you're doing is you're making a general rule that in-house counsel are not entitled to reinstatement. If you are making that general rule, which even Menard says it's not asking you to make, then you are running head on into the issue of preemption and the supremacy clause, because you are saying that a certain type of plaintiff is not entitled to the full remedies that are available under Title VII and the Equal Pay Act.
Oh, what if I don't make such a broad rule, but I rule that in this particular case, given the history of these parties, that it really is kind of like a ticket for Oshkosh on Tuesdays, and that's the way this case is going to come down?
Well, if you do that, then you come up into another area, which is the limited scope of review of the arbitrator's award. Now,
we can always review an arbitrator's award to see if they exceeded their authority. That's totally
true.
In our jurisprudence.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Did the arbitrators exceed their authority here? The arbitration agreement says it would be under the trip. First of all, the point that was raised on how the arbitrators were selected. Counsel for Ms. Sands provided a list. 7, 8, 9 lawyers.
I read the arbitration agreement, and I wish it were as simple as looking at paragraph 4 and saying that they decided not on these remedies, but paragraph 4 says the remedies under state and federal law. And so there's, I'm not going to go there, so you need to try to find another place if you're going to persuade me that the arbitrator did not exceed, the panel did not exceed their authority by requiring reinstatement in this particular case.
Well, from the court's remarks, I assume the court is acknowledging that the arbitrators were empowered to grant whatever relief was available under federal law.
You know, all I know is what the agreement says, and I didn't see a limitation that opposing counsel raises in the arbitration contract. I haven't read the whole record, I have to be frank with you, but I've read the contract.
So then the question becomes, on the facts of this case, did they exceed their authority?
Right.
Now, the big ground they raise after that is the issue of hostility. Is there so much hostility that the arbitrator should not have awarded reinstatement? Now, and that is one of the two grounds that federal courts recognize for denying reinstatement.
Right, right.
But the important thing there, and this is the Brusso case from the Seventh Circuit, the important thing there is that the hostility that must be looked at is the hostility that existed in the job place at the time or prior to the time of the firing, not hostility that is created or rancor that arises because of the aggressive advocacy of the plaintiff or her lawyer, or that she wins the case. And that is exactly the hostility that the arbitrators focused on when they decided on reinstatement. They looked at, was the workplace hostile before she was fired, and they specifically cited the hostility of John Menard to her before he fired her, and they said that's not sufficient. And that was the proper inquiry for them to make. So, you know, a court may have decided it differently, but that isn't the standard. The standard is, I mean, was it so egregious? And then the Court of Appeals analysis, did they disregard clearly established law? Well, here we are. This is admittedly, the amicus admits, this is a case of first impression. So how could they have disregarded clearly established law that didn't exist, that you may be about to make? And so that's, and also there's a significant fact here, which is that Menard, in its post-trial, its post-arbitration brief, at page 42, they specifically say Menard disputes that there was any hostile work environment that forced Sands to quit. So
may I ask you a question? Let's say Ms. Sands were general counsel at the General Motors plant in Janesville, and all the same facts are present, except the General Motors plant closes, and the arbitrators require reinstatement. What would a court do in that situation?
Well, in that situation, there's no job. And the court would say, if there's no job, that's one of the recognized reasons for awarding front pay in lieu of reinstatement. So the arbitrators would have made a mistake in that case.
But does it say that in the statute?
Well, the statute provides for reinstatement. The decisions have unanimously said front pay is an alternative, and the two conditions that they have cited are when the job's no longer there and hostility. And in this case, hostility, the job is there. Hostility was looked at quite properly, and the arbitrators, within their discretion, decided it wasn't sufficient. Now, I also want to, because the point was raised about the statute.
Which statute?
The 788.
11 or 10?
11.2.
The modification statute?
Yes. 788.11.1. The statute says, in either of the following cases, the court in and for the county wherein the award was made must make an order modifying or correcting the award upon the application of any party to the arbitration. 788.11.1b says, where the arbitrators have awarded upon a matter not submitted to them, unless it is a matter not affecting the merits of the decision upon the matter submitted. So that would appear to cover this situation. And then 788.11.2 says, the order must modify and correct the award so as to affect the intent thereof and promote justice between the parties. So I believe that this court could remand this matter to the district court to permit the parties to make application under 788.11.1 for a modification of the award because the arbitrators have awarded upon a matter not submitted to them, if you find that. Although I don't believe you should, but I think that statute provides you the leeway to do that to avoid the obvious injustice that would result if you vacate the award.
Yeah, but your position is it was submitted. Your position is it was submitted.
Oh, yes.
Your position is that the arbitration agreement specifically says that the arbitrator can decide the issues under the federal and state law, which includes, this doesn't say which includes reinstatement, but that's part of it.
That's right.
So you'd really have to read that agreement very, shall I say, peculiarly, or have to say that there's a conflict between that provision and the provision that says she should state her claim. And the general rule about asking a party to state the claim, which they always do in a complaint, is, you know, it doesn't tie them, doesn't bind them.
That's exactly what she did here, because in addition to asking for front pay, she asked for any injunctive relief deemed applicable by the panel, in parentheses, Title VII and WFEA, close paren, and 9, any other relief available and deemed applicable by the panel. So I don't think she limited herself.
So even if you say that that provision is binding, you're telling me that her claim then included anything that was lawful?
Yes. Yes.
I have a question that goes back to the state constitutional provision that deals with that you have a client of your choice, right?
Yes.
It says in court. Does that mean that it affects people outside of court?
The statute says in court.
Yeah.
I don't know the
answer. In fact, your client, Ms. Sands, can't represent the corporation in court unless she's a Wisconsin lawyer. By definition, in-house counsel can't do that in Wisconsin.
So that would mean the constitutional provision would seem not to apply here.
Is she a Wisconsin lawyer?
No, she's licensed in Minnesota.
I have another question. And that is, even in court, we have cases where the client says, I don't want them. I can't get along with a lawyer. Lawyer's not listening to me, not doing what I want. I want to get rid of him. And the court will say, you keep him, or we're going ahead and you can represent yourself. Because it's the court's obligation to make a determination whether you proceed or you're going to get a continuance. So the right to counsel of your choice is not absolute.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we have cited that in other instances in our brief. That's true.
That favors you, but the SCR, now I have to figure out which is at issue. The SCR here, which is at page 37 of your brief says, declining or terminating representation, except as paragraph C, a lawyer shall not represent a client or where representation is commenced, shall withdraw from the representation of a client if the lawyer is discharged. Now, the argument is Menard has discharged its lawyer. And for Ms. Sands to continue representing the corporation when she has been discharged violates that code provision. How do you get around that?
Because what the consequence of making a ruling on that would be to create a rule, not for this specific case, but for any house counsel who is terminated anywhere by an employer, and the federal courts have rejected that, and that would run squarely into the preemption and supremacy issues that prohibit any kind of limitation of the federal remedies that an employee is entitled to, including house counsel. So that I think that's the answer to that.
Counsel, I have two questions. The first is a follow-up to your response to Justice Eagler's question about can your client really perform the duties of general counsel? And your response was an unequivocal yes. And that raised in my mind the question of, well, what's changed? What's changed here since your client's testimony in front of the arbitration panel that no reasonable person would order reinstatement here? Now, I think a reasonable inference from that is that she would foresee difficulties in such a relationship.
Well, what's changed is that she's had time to reflect on it. The panel went and did it anyway, so that's what she's got. That's what she's got to deal with. There is no canon of ethics that says thou shalt love thy client. And anybody who's been in private practice, I think.
And the second question I have goes back in full circle to the outline that you started to present at the beginning of your presentation. That's the third part of your outline, which is, okay, what's the practical effect of whatever ruling comes out of this court as a result of this hearing?
Well, if you vacate reinstatement and say she's entitled to nothing, that is a gross miscarriage of justice, I believe. And it also frustrates the intent of the arbitrator's award, which was to provide her with compensation as well as the job. If you say that it's vacated, but you send it back to the district court to correct the award for the value of the reinstatement or front pay, that, you know, then you are effectuating the arbitrator's award. If you affirm, they're not going to reinstate her, so we go back to the contempt hearing where we determine the value of the reinstatement, which does effectuate the intent of the arbitrator.
Well, that's, as far as the second one goes, the reinstatement stands, hypothetically, reinstatement stands, and how long? I mean, I guess that goes to the practical effect of what the panel intended. I mean, how long was that order to continue?
Well, they ordered her. They didn't order her reinstated for a year or 2 years. They ordered her reinstated, and that's a matter of proof. What is the reasonable expectation of how long she could be there, and what is its value? So that is what the hearing is going to be about. That's a matter of evidence, testimony, both fact testimony and expert testimony.
What about the mitigation issue, the job in Chicago? The opposing counsel raises the argument that that was going to pay more than even the arbitrator's panel. How does that influence your argument?
There are two things about that. First of all, it was not a comparable position. It was not the position of house counsel. It was basically to be an OSHA lawyer. And second, it was not in the locality. It was to be, she was to go to Washington, D.C. instead of Eau Claire, where her family is and her home. So, but they have the right, mitigation is something that will come into play, I assume, we don't think it should, but Judge Lenz has indicated that they're going to be able to present whatever defense they've got on mitigation. We're prepared to deal with that. But and that did have an impact on the panel limiting back pay, but it did not affect their decision on front pay and to make to compensate her for the future. But yeah, that's how that figures.
Ms. Sands was in her former position was the public spokesman with the media for Menards.
She was.
And would the reinstatement continue that?
Well, the reinstatement is to her position of vice president and executive general counsel. Presumably, the employer has the right to define the duties, so I don't know if that would continue.
But if it didn't continue, then they'd have to find other people, another person to do that. Is that right?
Well, I don't think there were any complaints about her performance in that regard. I mean,
how could Ms. Sands represent Menards after she called Mr. Menard monstrous and reprehensible? I mean, here you're going out talking to the public. I represent Menards, and my boss is monstrous and reprehensible.
That's a decision she has to make for herself. It does not affect the award or vitiate the award of reinstatement because it's a statement made in the course of the litigation. It is not hostility that existed before the litigation. And there was a lot that happened in that litigation, such as John Menard threatening the life of a witness. And she's not the only one that said they were reprehensible. I said the second question is, why did the panel do what it did? Well, I see my time is up, if I can just finish this sentence. Three times in that award, their conduct is called reprehensible, and the panel says, if you can show us another case where the CEO of a Fortune 500 company personally threatened and badgered an employee and personally fired her and then threatened the life of a witness in the proceedings, we'd like to know about it.
Counsel, thank you very much. Ms. Hannon?
Thank you. Counsel's last statements underscored the absurdity and unreasonableness and what is really the arbitration panel's own brand of justice in saying that Ms. Sands should be reinstated.
There is a quote that sometimes I start with in a discussion, and it's, you speak to me of practicality, et cetera, et cetera. I won't bore you. And so much of this discussion is, you speak to me of practicality, yet we are a court based on a rule of law. So I want to talk also about the law, not just individuals' concepts of practicality. How, if at all, did the arbitrators exceed their legal authority in awarding reinstatement?
Because they manifestly disregarded the law. They disregarded and did not discuss at all the constitutional protection of a client's right of choice. They disregarded and did not discuss at all the ethical constraints that protect a client.
Okay. My concern is this. Although you seem to frame this as an individual case just on these facts, your opposing counsel says, hey, if you're going to rely on the constitutional right to choose your own client or rely on the ethical consideration, then your holding is much, much broader. And he says that's really what's being, it would be much broader. And that every in-house counsel then would not be entitled to reinstatement. How do you respond to that?
First, I want to be clear. We aren't asking for a bright line rule.
You say that, but if you rely on the Constitution and the ethical considerations that apply to everyone, then how can you say that it's just a very narrow, narrow case and we're not asking for a bright line?
I think the narrowest way to vacate the reinstatement portion of the ward is to say that the panel went beyond the authority granted to it and awarded a remedy that the parties had not authorized it to grant. Now, that's the narrowest basis. The next step would be to say that the panel manifestly disregarded Wisconsin and national case law about factors addressing when reinstatement is not appropriate. The Kempfer case is a Wisconsin case. The Salveson case is a Wisconsin case. When the employee is going to be sent back to respond to the person who was the harasser, if that's the manager, that's untenable for reinstatement. Then we can go beyond that to talk about the constitutional protections. And I agree, we've never said it's an absolute protection. There are concerns for efficient judicial administration at times when courts, mostly in criminal case settings, say, we're not going to give you a third lawyer on the eve of trial. Well, that's not this case. I think the court will have to take up how the Constitution affects this or doesn't if it affirms. It can more narrowly base a decision to vacate. But because it's raised, I think if it's affirmed, what role that constitutional provision plays has to be addressed.
Counsel, your opposing counsel made an argument in regard to the panel's consideration of the hostility issue. And in particular, I refer to that section pertaining to the circumstances and the conduct as was reported in regard to Mr. Menard during the actual termination event. Do you agree that the panel could not have taken that circumstance into consideration in determining whether there was such a hostile work environment that the employee should not be reinstated?
No, Justice Gableman. If your question is it can't go beyond the day of termination,
my question
for
was
instance,
very convoluted and many double negatives, so I apologize. What I'm trying to get at is I took it from opposing counsel. I might be wrong, but this is what I perceived him to say, that the panel properly weighed and considered whether there was such a hostile work environment that would preclude reinstatement because it could not legally take into consideration the circumstances of the termination. Is that comport with your understanding?
No. The case law, as I read it, I think Costin versus Plitt is one of them that talks about hostility in litigation can be taken into account. It may not be the only reason. I don't think opposing counsel is saying all of this negative verbiage in all of Ms. Sands' briefs at every level is just going to blow over and reinstatement will be.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is the termination discussion a part of litigation? I understand things are said during litigation. Things are said that people want to come back from a lot of times. But the actual event, the termination event, is there some authority out there that says that cannot be taken into consideration in determining hostile work environment?
I think the authority says that is considered, but it's not necessarily the only consideration. And I think the familial angst that Ms. Sands talked about and recognized by this $1 million that the panel awarded her, that was an ongoing thing. It was reiterated at the circuit court level, certainly in the briefs to the Court of Appeals. I'm not sure if did I answer your question.
Your case would be easier if this was a trial court being reviewed, wouldn't it, than an arbitration award?
Perhaps because of the standard of review, although, you know, I'm
that's
comfortable we've met it. But all the factors as far as real hostility between the parties, that would be at play in a circuit court consideration. The level of sensitivity of the position. I really think hostility has to be looked at in the context of what position are we talking about? A degree of involvement with strategy, policymaking.
Ms. Hannon, thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Mr. Schultz and Mr. Ritchie for your participation in a very interesting and new kind of case for the court and maybe for the nation relating to arbitration awards in retaliatory firings. And so ends 08AP 1703, Dorn M. Sands and Menard, Inc. And Mr. Schulman, we enjoyed having you with us in Wisconsin as a lawyer for this brief time, but you're not entitled to do anything else here. Safely home. And that goes for all of you. So the court's in recess until 1:30. And Justice Ziegler will be out to talk with the students about the procedures in the court, and everybody is welcome to stay for that. We are in recess.